We're starting this morning a new short series for the next month or so on the topic of worship. Subsequent lessons are going to be looking into more specific issues around worship. But for today, I'm sort of looking at the big picture, the view from 30,000 feet, as it were. What is worship? What calls us to worship? And what does worship tell us about who we are and who we're meant to be? So with that in mind, I'm going to start this morning in what might, on first glance, appear to be an unusual starting point on the topic. And that's Romans chapter 1. But bear with me. Let's read together. Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being, and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over to their sinful desires of their hearts, to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed shameful acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their error. Furthermore, just as they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, so God gave them over to a depraved mind, so that they do not do what ought not to be done. They've become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed and depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit and malice. They're gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They have no understanding, no fidelity, no love, no mercy. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. So what's Paul talking about here? What's he describing? It's a pretty bleak picture, isn't it? Just pick out the adjectives there. Godless, wicked, futile, foolish, sinful, shameful, depraved. It's really a summation of the wretched state of man because of his sin. The diversity of his sin and the comprehensiveness of sin in all its forms. But it wasn't always like this. It needn't be like this. The first paragraph has a little bit of positivity to it. There's clarity and simplicity and understanding. God is clearly and plainly known and understood. But it does really draw a sharp contrast to what's to come. Something changed. And it wasn't God who changed. It wasn't even the creation that clearly pointed to God and made God clearly known. No, what changed was the minds and hearts of man. Man suppresses the plain truth. He hides the truth, ignores the truth. How? By taking his eyes off God. As Paul writes, they knew God, but they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But more than that, at the same time that they've taken their eyes off God, they've also turned their attention to other God substitutes. They became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being. And more pointedly, they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. So this is the idea I want to flesh out a bit more this morning. They serve created things rather than the Creator. You might say they confused the Creator with the creation. They substituted the Creator with the creation. So I need to introduce a couple of terms here that I think will help us talk about these things. The first is immanent, or immanence, not immanent, immanent, which basically means to be within something. To be within, in our context, we might talk about being within the physical world or within the creation. So when we talk about something being immanent, we're talking about the world that we might see around us, the world that we're a part of, things that we can see and touch, the creation at large. And the other word is transcendent or transcendence. This means beyond or above, things beyond the physical world, things beyond creation. We might say spiritual, but I think it's a bit more than that. It's not that simple. But without getting bogged down in all the metaphysics, I want to draw this contrast between the immanent and the transcendent. See, I think we see this played out in Romans chapter 1 that we read. There's a turn in this focus away from the transcendent, away from God, away from the Creator. And there's this turn towards the immanent, towards the creation, ignoring God and instead glorifying and worshipping created things, things within creation. Things created by God, yes, but also things created by man. We think of all sorts of idols, totem poles, these sorts of things. And this in turn, this focus that leads mankind into this wretched state of sin that Paul describes in detail. So this is a profound shift. But as I mentioned before, it isn't just about this distinction between the physical world and the spiritual world. That's kind of a Gnostic idea, and we don't really want to go there. But I think it is the distinction between the Creator and creation. Because God, the Creator, and the world or universe He created, both physical and spiritual. It isn't just that mankind's turned his back on the spiritual, but he's turned his back on the Creator. The creature has rejected his Creator. We've lost sight of our existence as creatures. And as I said, this is a profound perversion when you think about it. When we recognize ourselves as creatures, it changes so much about how we see ourselves, how we see our lives and our purpose with our lives. If we're creatures that are made by a transcendent Creator, it means that we are made in a certain way. It means we are made to do certain things. And if you think about it, this is really a limiting reality. Because if we are made to do a specific thing in specific ways, it really implies that there are ways that we aren't made, things that we aren't meant to do. There's a givenness, if you let me use that word, to our existence. We've been given by our Creator certain things, but there are also things that He hasn't given us. We aren't transcendent. There isn't an immanent world that we are created within. And let me remind you once again, this isn't this distinction between the physical world and the spiritual world, because we know that we are physical and spiritual beings ourselves. It's not that we're talking about that spiritual, physical distinction. It's about us being created beings, not creators as God is a creator. We are creatures that are created. And I want to suggest that this break between the creature and the Creator that Paul describes explains a whole lot, not just about the signs of wickedness that Paul describes from his own day, and indeed our own day, but also a lot of what we do see in our own day. I want to just give you a few examples to impress upon you. Firstly, there's a famous quote from the US Supreme Court decision in 1992 called Planned Parenthood vs. Casey, which, apart from the more famous Roe vs. Wade decision back in the 70s, it continued to uphold this purported constitutional right to an abortion. But in that judicial decision, the judge, Anthony Kennedy, wrote these words: "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." Think about what he's saying there. Our existence isn't defined for us as creatures by a creator. There's no givenness in our lives. Instead, we're left to our own devices to make it up for ourselves. And far be it from the government to stand in anybody's way in that pursuit. Isn't that the mantra of the society that we see around us? My life isn't given to me. My life is defined by me. It's for me. I'm in charge. I get to decide all these things. I'm in control. And I don't have to answer to any creator that might transcend my existence. Indeed, we see our world around us increasingly rejecting any sense of this givenness, any sense of limitation on our existence as it's being created for us. Reflect for a moment on this other quote from Francis Bacon, who was the father of modern science, writing in the early 17th century. He described that science ought to be, quote, "for the glory of the Creator and the relief of man's estate." Now, on face value, this seems perfectly reasonable, and perhaps this is exactly what Francis meant. In our scientific pursuit of progress, as it were, scientific progress, we both glorify our Creator. Great. God created this world. Let's understand it. But also, we make things better for ourselves, don't we? We cure diseases. We ease suffering. We invent air conditioning and vaccines and all these sorts of things that make our lives better. And that's also great. But if you think about that phrase, relief of man's estate, could this not also mean a relief from our state as creatures that are made by the Creator? That is, by using science, we can release these shackles of the givenness of our existence, these ordained limitations as creatures, ultimately rejecting our Creator altogether and even becoming creators ourselves. Surely we don't need to use our imaginations to see this interpretation of science playing out in the world around us. Just a few examples. Think about many of the recent developments in gene editing, and perhaps most recently what's known as CRISPR. I'm not going to pretend to be at all familiar with what exactly this is or what it does. I'm not a scientist or a geneticist or anything like that. But you might have heard it recently referred to when two Chinese twins were born with edited genes that apparently would make them immune to the HIV virus. Which on the face of it sounds like a good thing, making people immune to HIV. But this is more than just a vaccine that trains our immune response. It's more profound. It's tweaking the fundamental genetic building blocks of the human genome, the entire human life, and significantly all their subsequent generations carry that same alteration in their genes. And of course, curing and preventing diseases is one thing, of course. And we can, I suppose, debate those sorts of issues. But what about creating so-called superhumans, humans that are stronger, humans that are more intelligent, more whatever you want to call it. And there's people there desiring to do exactly that. But isn't this a rejection of our givenness as humans, our position as creatures that are made a certain way? Isn't there a sense in which we're beginning to go beyond simply being creatures and supplanting the Creator in that way. You might have also heard words like transhumanism or the singularity floating about. You just need to watch an episode of Black Mirror and you'll see that cropping up all the time. This idea that we can merge with machines, even upload our consciousness to the cloud. If that sounds like complete nonsense, it kind of is, but this is what people seriously talk about. But you see that sense in which people hope to transcend the physical world, their physical bodies even, and become something more than we were ever created to be, living in this utopia inside a computer simulation. Sounds like science fiction, but people are actually pursuing that, as crazy as it sounds. It's the same for things like transgenderism. But of course, people starting today to talk about being transracial or transable or even trans species. We might see much of that as nonsense, but do you see how this is a fundamental rejection of the body as a given, something that's given to us? And therefore we force our body through increasingly extreme measures to conform to our own will of what we want our body to be, for whatever reason that is. Rejecting what was created by becoming the creator ourselves. Indeed, we see these interventions, any intervention, as a vile into this these pursuits as a violation of our fundamental human rights. Anthony Kennedy would be proud of us. And that brings me back to abortion. Think about it. Whether it's a means of birth control or sex selection or even selection from conditions like Down syndrome, can you see how this is fundamentally another rejection of the givenness of our nature, of our being? When you used to have a baby, you had no choice what sex it was going to be. It was given to you. You were given a son or a daughter. Now we can choose. We're in control. It's not God's choice anymore. It's our choice. It's the same for euthanasia. We're even in charge of our own death. Our appointed time, as it were, is no longer given to us. It's no longer up to God, our Creator. It's ours to choose. Indeed, as an antidote to suffering, euthanasia is a rejection of the givenness of suffering. Think about that for a moment. A rejection of the value or importance of suffering. As such, any type of suffering is just one aspect of this estate of man that Francis Bacon described, that we might seek to relieve in all its forms. Because to suffer is to concede to our limitations as creatures, so we have to reject it, however that might be. And in that, you can see how this starts to stray beyond these perhaps more practical matters into more philosophical matters, into what we actually value. If our ethics are purely utilitarian, as much of the ethics behind people pushing a lot of these things is, then think about values such as honesty, patience, resilience, humility. Aren't these just relics of our existence as creatures? Ways of dealing with our givenness and limitations? Once we're in control and broken free from those limitations, we don't need these things. We don't need to be patient. We don't need to be honest if that gets in the way of pursuing these goals. We don't need humility. In fact, you can pretty much throw out most of the fruit of the Spirit that Terry talked about last week. That's about being a creature, isn't it? Any situation that calls for patience or self-control, well, that's just something that needs to be eliminated, programmed or systematized or legislated out of existence. So I hope I've impressed on you this deep rift that we see in the world around us and how at the heart of this is the question of creator and creation, of giver and givenness, of the transcendent and the imminent. And I hope this hasn't been a fruitless diversion, because I want to put it to you that this is the very question that is at the heart of the concept of worship. Just as there is a creator and a creature, a transcendent and an immanent, there's also a worshipper and a worshipee. We're made by God and we're made to worship him. And as we saw in Romans chapter 1, disordered worship is at the heart of man's corrupted state, when they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. Now, before we go any further, let's talk for a moment about the word worship. In Greek, there's several words that are translated worship. I just want to focus on the three main ones. The first is sebo, which means to revere, to have reverence towards another. That's the word we saw in Romans chapter 1, where man worshipped created things. So there's that sense of respect and honour involved in that word. The second is proskuneo, which literally means to kiss towards, like a dog perhaps licking its master's hand, or the proverbial kissing of the ring, that act of respect and subservience, because this isn't a kiss of romance or passion, but subservience. And that's interesting. This is the word that Satan uses when tempting Jesus to bow down and worship him in Jesus' temptation. The third word is latreo, which means to serve, either an earthly master or almost exclusively, as we see in the Bible, to serve God. We see this again in Romans 1, where they worshipped and served created things. So there's two of those words that are often translated worship there in that phrase. So in these three words, I think we see some of these different aspects of worship: reverence, subservience, service. But the one thing they all have in common is this sense of otherness between two entities, if you will. These two entities involved as the worshipper and the worshipees, they're not the same. They're not on the same level. There's the reverent and the revered, the kisser and the kissee, the server and the master. You might say the immanent and the transcendent. I want to share just a couple of passages that highlight this sense of transcendence in worship. Firstly, in Romans chapter 11. This is after Paul concludes his long treatise on God's work of salvation. He finishes with this flurry of praise and worship. Starting in verse 33 of chapter 11, Paul writes, "Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God! How unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should ever repay them? For from him and through him and for him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen." Notice how he describes God. God's transcendent. Who knows God's mind? He's unsearchable to us. From him, through him, and for him are all things. That's a transcendent creator right there. And for that reason, worship and glory belong to him. Similarly, in Psalm 113, verses 4 to 6, "The Lord's exalted over all the nations, his glory above the heavens. Who is like the Lord our God, the one who sits enthroned on high, who stoops down to look on the heavens and the earth?" God's up there, even above the heavens. We're down here. We're not equal to God, and we're certainly not better than God. Transcendence. But there's more to our worshipping God than this transcendence alone, because transcendence isn't the same thing as remoteness. If God was remote, we wouldn't really be able to relate to him in any meaningful way. Worship would just be a gesture. But we also know that God is immanent in the sense that he is involved with his creation, most profoundly through the incarnation of Jesus. As John puts it, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. We also know that the book of Hebrews discusses at length Jesus' incarnation and how, rather than trivializing the transcendence of God, this incarnation actually deepens our relationship with God, as Jesus is uniquely qualified to as our high priest through that incarnation. So there's the transcendence of God, but also the immanence of God through Jesus. So far I've kind of described worship as a sort of posture between us as God's creation, made in his image, and God as our creator. But worship is more than just a passive posture. It's something that we actively do. Mankind in Romans chapter 1 didn't just take a certain attitude towards God, but they acted on it, making their own gods and serving their own passions and lusts. Similarly, truly ordered worship of God moves us to act in certain ways. And so to this end, I want to point us once more to Romans, this time chapter 12, starting from verse 1. Therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing and perfect will. I'm sure we're all familiar with this passage, but I want to suggest that we see here a sort of process, an arc, if you will, that describes the purpose or goal of worship. Notice, of course, this follows on immediately from that song of worship that we read from a moment ago, from chapter 11. Paul marvels at the transcendence of God, having just described God's wonderful mercy through his plan of salvation. And I'm going to call that awe. In view of everything God's done, wow. But because of that, offer yourselves as living sacrifices. Sacrifice yourself. Humble yourself. Awe leads to humility. This is worship. But then flowing from that, we're transformed to the knowledge and alignment with God's will. We know God's will and we obey God's will. Obedience. So we see this arc from awe to humility and obedience. Contrast that with the sinful man in chapter 1. He ignores God, which leads to pride and ultimately rebellion against God in all sorts of ways. So this is how true worship works. Know who God is and what he has done. Or know who we are and what we've done. Humility. And know how that calls us to live in obedience. So when I think about these things, I kind of get the feeling that, speaking for myself at least, we do a lot and talk a lot about humility and obedience, but we sometimes fall short on the first part, the awe. But if that's the case, aren't we missing something? Do we miss that sense of transcendence in our understanding of worship and in what we do as worship? I don't mean that in a mystical or happy-clappy kind of way. Goodness knows there's plenty of ways to fake that sense of transcendence. If you just get the right lighting, pick the right song in the right key, candles and organs help. Perhaps even fancy robes and incense helps. Now, all of that can be genuine. I don't want to be flippant about it, but all that is easy, it's easy to fake that sense, that mood of transcendence. And fake transcendence is no transcendence at all. But at the same time, we are more than just a school or a book club, aren't we? We're a family. We're God's kingdom in this world. Do we experience genuine awe when we read or sing about God's love for us? Are we genuinely humbled and driven to obedience when we remember Jesus' sacrifice for us around the Lord's Supper? Do we connect with the all-powerful, transcendent Creator when we come before Him in prayer? Do we sense the eternal when we work together with one another and share together as brothers and sisters? So it's some food for thought. Hopefully I've whetted your appetites and got your minds ticking over in anticipation of the weeks to come, where we're going to reflect in more detail about what worship is and what we do. I'm just going to close this morning with this brief reading from Psalm 19 to kind of bring us back to where we started, reminding us of who God is, the Creator of the heavens and the earth, our Creator, revealed plainly in His creation, so we're without excuse. Psalm 19, verse 1 to 4. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech, they use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world.